Das Thakur ki jai. Prem shikaho shri krishna chaitanya prabhu nityananda shri doita gadadhar shri vasadi gaur bhakta vrinda ki jai. Shri shri radha krishna go gopinath shyama kunda radha kunda giri govardhana ki jai. Vrindavan dhamma ki jai. Mathura dhamma ki jai. Abhadweep mayapur dhamma ki jai. Jagannath puri dhamma ki jai. Ganga Maha Jumna Devi ki jai. Bhakti Devi ki jai. Tosi Maharani ki jai. Samaveta Bhakta Vrinda ki jai. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. Krishna Prasthaya Bhujamani Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Nityanamani. Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pacharani Nusasa Sanyuani Paskajaya Satani. Nandeham Shri Guru Shri Vijapada Kamalam Shri Guru and Vaishnava Shri Rupam Sagra Jatam Sagana Raghunatham Vitham Stam Sajiva Sadavaitam Sadhudam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Deva Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sagana Lavita Shri Vishakam Vitam Chachan Ajkapa Chudasaka Sandhya Vichapa Chitanam Bhavanevi O Vaishnava. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. September 8th, 2016, in Radadesh, Belgium, and we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 7, Chapter 10, Prahlad, the Best Among Exalted Devotees, Text 20 and 21. So text 21 is on the board. Can you read through text 20? Saratmana hiyam santi bhutagrame shukinchana uvachaste judaichendra madbhava vikataspriha. This is again to Singhadev talking to Prahlad. My dear Prahlada, king of the Daityas. He's only 5 years old. King of the Daityas. Because of being attached to devotional service to me, my devotee does not distinguish between lower and higher living entities. In all respects, he is never jealous of anyone. Text 21. Bhavanti purusha loke. Madhakastva manuvrata bhavame kalu bhaktanam sarvesham pratirupadrik bhavanti become purushaha persons loke in this world, mat bhaktaha, my pure devotees, tvam, you, anuvrakaha, following in your footsteps, bhavan, you, me, my, kalu, indeed, bhaktanam, of all devotees, sarvesham, in different mellows, Prati Rupa Drik, tangible example. Translation purport by Srila Prabhupada. Again, this is Nisingadev talking to Prabhupada. Those who follow your example will naturally become my pure devotees. You are the best example of my devotees, and others should follow in your footsteps. Does anybody remember from 3 minutes ago what was the quality that Lord Nisingadev said in verse 20? That made Prahlad Maharaj the best of the devotees. Because he's fine. Because he's fine. That's very sweet, but it wasn't in the previous verse, but that's real sweet. Okay, should we read the previous verse again? My dear Prahlada, king of the Daityas, because of being attached to devotional service to me, my devotee does not distinguish between lower and higher living entities in all respects. He is never jealous of anyone. Those who follow your example, the what example? The example of?
Not being jealous.
Not seeing lower or higher. Will naturally become my pure devotees. You are the best example of my devotee, and others should follow in your footsteps. Purport. In In this connection, Srila Madhvacharya quotes a verse from the Skanda Purana, Rite tu tat vikam devam naradam deems tatai vacha praradhad uttama ko nu vishnu bhaktau jagat kaye. There are many, many devotees of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and they have been enumerated in the Srimad Bhagavatam 6.3.20 as follows. Anybody know 6.3.20? Famous. It's a famous, important verse. Oh, that's a good one, but that's in 7. That's in 7. It's about Prahlad, and it's in 6. Okay, 6.3.20. What's going on in the beginning of the 6th canto? What's going on at the end of the 5th canto? That might help us. The very, very end of the 5th canto. Very, very end. Come on, come on, you guys. This is the Shastric center of the universe here in Radhadesh. What's at the end of the 5th canto? It's very sad. Something very sad at the end of the 5th canto. The house planets, good. And then, you remember that Maharaj Parikit is really sad after hearing about the hellish planets. And he asks how we can get free of the hellish planets. Right? So what is Sukadeva Goswami, what's the story he talks about? Ajamya. Good. Okay, so this is 6.3. This is the third chapter of the 6th canto. So it's in the Ajamya story. And this is the point when the Yamadutas are talking to Yamaraja. And their main complaint was, how can there be many authorities? Remember that? Okay. So what verse did Yamaraj say that has Prahlad's name in it? Very, very famous verse. What is it about, if you don't remember the Sanskrit? Yes, excellent. Excellent, excellent. The Mahajans. 6.3.20. Svayambhur Narada Sambhu Komara Kapilo Manu Prahlado Janaka Bhishmo Balir Vyasakir. Yeah. Vyasakir is okay, and Vayam in that verse is, it's like aham, so he met himself. So Yamaraj is saying, I'm one of the hundreds. Okay, Prabhupada says, of the 12 authorized devotees, Lord Brahma, Narada, Lord Shiva, Kapila, Manu, and so on, Prahlad Maharaj is understood to be the best. Bhavanti purusha loke mad bhaktastam anuvrataha bhavan me kalu bhaktanam sarvesham pratirupadrik. I'm going to read the translation of both verses. My dear Prahlad, king of the Daityas, because of being attached to devotional service to me, my devotee does not distinguish between lower and higher living entities. In all respects, he is never jealous of anyone. Those who follow your example will naturally become my pure devotees. You are the best example of my devotee, and others should follow in your footsteps. So Prahlad is the best among all the devotees, specifically among all the Mahajans. That's pretty amazing, isn't it? Of course, we all know that when we talk about the best devotee, there are lots and lots and lots of best devotees, and this word best is not really an absolute kind of word. So usually when we use the word best, we mean that it's some kind of absolute, unique thing, and that there's none better. But we also sometimes use the word best in a very general way, right? Wow, this is the best feast I've ever had. Is that necessarily a literally true statement? Probably not. We probably just mean it's really good. It's really good. It's really good. We use absolute terms in general ways all the time. This is a really unique experience. You know, if it's unique, uni means one. It means there's only one of them. So this tendency to use absolute terms in a general way is found in all societies and all languages, including in the Shastra, and including by the Lord here. Because here the Lord is saying, Prahlad, you're the very best devotee. So tomorrow when it's Radhastami, are we going to say that Radharani's not the best devotee anymore? Because we just read that Prahlad is the best devotee. Are we going to say that? I don't think so. All right. And we have, of course, in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita part 1, where Narada Muni keeps trying to find the best devotee. Prahlad's in there. but he's not the last one. He goes to the devotee. Yes, you're the best devotee. You've gotten Krishna's mercy. And every time the devotee says, no, I haven't gotten any mercy from Krishna. You have to find that devotee who's higher. Right? And none of the devotees say, yes, I'm the best. And Narada is having some difficulty finding who is the best devotee. And sometimes we say Lord Shiva is the best devotee. Right? Uddhava is the best devotee. Arjuna is the best devotee. Srimati Radharani is the best. Or who's the queen of Vrindavan? Because tomorrow's one house meeting. Say Radharani is the queen of Vrindavan. Who else is the queen of Vrindavan? Mahisoda, of course. And who else is the queen of Vrindavan? Vrindadevi. Yes. So, you know, one has to take them out like that. But here in Nrisingadev, keeping that in mind, Nrisingadev is saying Prahlad is the best of the devotees. Why is he the best of the devotees? Because he doesn't see higher or lower, and he's never envious of everyone. He's equal to everyone. He's equal to everyone. So that this is one of the main criteria for how advanced one is in bhakti. Those of us who were in Manashiksha, looking at the Uttam Bhakta, which definition of the Uttam Bhakta makes the same point? The topmost devotee.
Romance?
Well, no, which, you weren't there. There's different categories of Uttam Majjhima and Kanishta, right? Remember we had that chart? So which of those defines the Uttam Bhakta in this way? There's actually two places. Remember we said there was one in Manashiksha, one in the Nectar of Instruction, one in the Nectar of Devotion, one in the 11th Canto. Which one of them says the Uttam Bhakta is one who doesn't see higher or lower and is never jealous of anyone? You guys all didn't know you were going to get quizzed this morning. We should have prizes, right? 11th Canto. You don't see anybody higher than you, right? You see everyone equally. But also, what does Rupa Goswami say in the Nectar of Instruction? The Nectar of Instruction says the neophytes are chanting Hare Krishna, the Majjhimas have taken diction, they're worshipping the deities, and the Uttams, what? That's in the purport verse. The Uttam devotee is what? Well, yes, but specifically because they're free from what? Yes, but how is it worded? Yes, they're free from envy. How is it worded? Nectar of Instruction, text 5. The topmost devotee. Excellent. They're free from the propensity to criticize others. Two points Rupa Goswami is giving of the Uttam Bhakta, Nectar of Instruction, text 5. One is undeviating devotional service. Right? The Kanista just chants sometimes. The Majjhima has taken diction as worshipping the deity. They've made a commitment. And the Uttam, they haven't just made a commitment. They're undeviating. You know, I mean, frankly, you can take initiation and worship the deity and deviate. Yes? You can forget Krishna, even intentionally so. Isn't that correct? Am I right? Yes? It's not that everyone who has initiation and is worshipping the deity is 100% engaged in devotional service. So the Uttam is 100% engaged in devotional service, and they're free from the what? The propensity to criticize others. The propensity to criticize others. So that's one of the main symptoms of envy. Of jealousy here. Prahlad is not jealous of anyone. And it's interesting, the Singhadev says, because of your devotional service, you have given up this envy. Sometimes we think we will achieve devotional service if we give up envy, but it's actually by our bhakti that we give up envy. You can give up envy in other systems, but bhakti is the most klesha dikatrate sham avyakta avshatpate sham avyakta hi katir dukam dehavad bir avapite. The other systems are more troublesome. So let's look for a minute at this envy. And why is this such a crucial thing? And then let's look at the different grades of devotees, those who just achieve neutrality, those who achieve compassion, and Prahlad as the ultimate in the opposite of envy, which is compassion. So you've got, you know, at one hand you've got envy, neutrality, compassion, super compassion. You understand? So what is envy? Envy means that I don't want anyone to have anything equal to or better than me. You're welcome to having something that's lower than me. Go right ahead. But not equal and not greater. I have to be the top. And if you have something equal or greater, then I will try to push you down, take it away from you, negate you, criticize you in some way to get that away from you. That I find it intolerable if anybody has something equal to or greater than mine. You know, you can have a nice car, but my car has to be better. You can have an attractive spouse, my spouse has to be better. You can be smart, I have to be smarter. You know, you can be strong, I have to be stronger. And this general thing that I have to excel you. I can't tolerate anybody who is a competitor of mine. And Bhaktisiddhanta gives the example that you hear your old friend has become a high court judge, and you say, you know, I knew him as a boy, forget it. No way is he a high court judge. No, no, I saw him sitting on the bench. He was deciding cases. Well, then they must not be paying him. So you got to take something away. And the newspapers, the magazines, which are now, of course, also digital, are full of finding fault in exalted people. Isn't it? If you're rich, if you're beautiful, if you're famous, if you're strong, if you're intelligent, if you're powerful, if you're detached, let's find fault. Here's how the stars look like without their makeup. This is what actually goes on in the star's own home where they fight with each other. You know, right? Isn't it? Here's some rich, famous, powerful person and they actually have this problem. And everybody goes, yes, they're not really better than me. They're not really better than me. Look at the problems that they have that I don't have. Right? And a lot of what people like to hear about and talk about is other people's problems. And if there aren't any, they'll make them up. You know, I've noticed a tendency, we make up negative statistics. Have you noticed this? So once in Soho Street Temple, one gentleman said, why are only 10% of Prabhupada's disciples active in ISKCON? I said, where did you get that number from? Yeah. You know? And I ended up giving a whole class about research and statistics. And then I checked with Mahamaya, who keeps track of Prabhupada's disciples. I said, how many of Prabhupada's disciples are active in ISKCON? She said, over a third. Because she's the only one who really knows. And then I ask the devotees, when people make up numbers, or, you know, it's always interesting to hear the divorce statistics. So many devotees get divorced. Who keeps track of this? That's really just because, you know five people who got divorced in the last 2 years, and so you know, you might have that in your head. But when I did my research in 2005 of every single teacher in every single Hare Krishna school, all over the world, the number who were either divorced or widowed was 1.7%. And the number who were in a second marriage after either divorce or being widowed was only 2%. That's not a very high divorce rate. Now maybe just we have particularly moral gurukul teachers, I don't know. You know? But it could be. Maybe gurukul teachers are a particularly moral lot. Huh? But if we only have 1.7% of all of our teachers who get, that's divorced or widows, that wasn't even just divorce. And I asked the devotees, I said, when we make up these statistics, you know, we just pull them out of the air to sound very authoritative. Well, 40% of, you know. Is it usually negative or positive? What do you say? Negative. It's almost always negative. the tendency to criticize, to criticize, to criticize, to envy, to envy, to envy. Now, when envy gets even worse, so this is envy where I'm delighting in somebody else's suffering, basically. I'm taking pleasure in somebody else's difficulty. It's giving me a sense of happiness. Wow, look at that. They're not turning their rounds anymore. It's nasty. Right? And worse than that is when I take pleasure in being the cause of somebody's suffering. So basic envy is I'm happy at your suffering, and heavy duty envy is I'm happy at causing your suffering. I'm not just delighting that you're suffering. You know, and that's one of our big objections, of course, to meat eating. Meat eating is a very envious activity. That someone is getting pleasure from the suffering of the animals. And they're the cause of the suffering of the animals. They're the indirect, if you're sitting in a restaurant, obviously, you're the indirect cause, but you're the cause. You're paying somebody to torture and kill an animal so you can enjoy eating them. I mean, oh my God, it's horrible, isn't it? It's really horrible. I mean, if we want to think about what is the essence of evil, if we want to define evil, it would be I take my pleasure from causing suffering to others. Wouldn't that be the height of evil? Wouldn't that be a good definition?
Pretty good.
Pretty good, huh? Okay, great. So just like, you know, sometimes you read about these scam artists, and they look for vulnerable people. They look for elderly people, you know, who can't think so well anymore, and they steal their life savings. And they delight in that. They say, wow, you know, I tricked that old lady. You understand? They're delighting in being the cause of suffering to others. So all stealing is like that. Stealing, rape, arson, any kind of cheating. Any kind of cheating. Any time where we get a good deal at the expense of somebody else. And when we're thinking, you know, well, I'm so clever that I was able to get a good deal at the expense of somebody else. We never, I don't think ever, walk into a shop and say, are you sure you can sell this so cheaply? You know, are you going to have trouble paying your rent if you sell this so cheaply? I mean, just if we can be very, 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 very honest, please don't hate me, we do this even among the devotees. You know, how can I get as much service from that devotee and give them as little as possible? Or how can I, you know, live at a temple and get as much facility as possible and give as little service? You know, we have that. In every community, there are devotees who are living on temple property, sometimes for years, and doing just the bare minimum not to be kicked out. And you also see, you know, temple leaders who want to dry out the devotee and take every last ounce of service from them that they possibly can, while giving them as little as possible in return. So this is the same kind of mentality. You know, it's a mild form of it, but it's a kind of stealing mentality. And all of us, if we're conditioned souls, my dear friends, have this to some extent. Every time we laugh at somebody's misfortune. And this is a tricky thing for me as a teacher, and it's something I've really been grappling with as a preacher and a teacher, that in order to preach and teach, you have to give concrete examples of what you're talking about. You can't just talk theoretically. It doesn't work. Like here, we're giving Prahlad as a concrete example, a specific example. And we're told, not only don't criticize anyone, don't praise anyone, but as a teacher, if you don't give examples of people who are really good or really bad, nobody knows what you're talking about. It's all vague. You understand? But I've noticed that whenever I give an example of someone who's bad, a bad example, there's a tendency for us to delight in the fact that someone's a bad example. Are you all understanding what I'm saying? Oh, just like there was this person, they did this and that. Oh, hi. And how do you not do that? How do you give examples of here's a very envious person, or here's a very fallen, without the name, of course, unless they're in the Shastra and everybody knows their name, without people scoffing, without people taking a superior position and delighting that, oh, well, I wouldn't do that. It's a real challenge. All right, so how do we get free from this problem? And by the way, this problem is our problem. This is the core, the root, the essence, of our problem. The essence of our problem is I want to be the best, and I want to be the center, and I want to be honored, and I want to be worshipped, and I want everyone to notice me. And we exhibit this by wanting to put everyone else down. So these are it's the symptom of our core problem. And this problem tends to persist even when we're very advanced in spiritual discipline, because it's the core problem. So one way to deal with it is to try to develop neutrality. Just neutrality towards everyone. And Krishna talks a lot about neutrality in the Bhagavad Gita and a lot about neutrality in the Bhagavatam. Neutrality, not seeing friends or enemies. Not seeing friends, enemies, or neutral. Seeing everyone equally. And I thought I'd just read a little bit from the 11th canto about this kind of neutrality and what do we mean by this neutrality as opposed to envy. So Krishna is saying to Uddhava, even though neglected, insulted, I'll read this slowly actually, even though neglected, insulted, ridiculed, or envied by bad men, or even though repeatedly agitated by being beaten, tied up, or deprived of one's occupation, spat upon, or polluted with urine by ignorant people, one who desires the highest goal in life should, in spite of all these difficulties, use his intelligence to keep himself safe on the spiritual platform. That's neutrality. And Uddhava says, I don't really think I can understand this very well. Uddhava says, the conditioning of one's personality in material life is very strong, and therefore it is very difficult even for learned men to tolerate the offenses committed against them by ignorant people. Now he's going to make the same point as Singhadev is making. Only your devotees who are fixed in your loving service and who have achieved peace by residing at your lotus feet are able to tolerate such offenses. So Krishna then agrees with this because he says, O disciple of Brihaspati, there is virtually no saintly man in this world capable of resettling his own mind after it has been disturbed by the insulting words of uncivilized men. Sharp arrows which pierce one's chest and reach the heart do not cause as much suffering as the arrows of harsh, insulting words that become lodged within the heart when spoken by uncivilized men. So Uddhava and Krishna are both agreeing here that the biggest challenge to this equanimity and neutrality is when we're attacked in some way, especially when we're insulted. Well, why is that? Because as soon as we're insulted or attacked, what's being diminished? Our status. You follow? Right? Envy is, I've got to have the highest status in something. And when someone insults us, offends us, they're diminishing our status. And Krishna is saying even saintly persons, they feel this more than if someone literally physically shot them in the heart. And they have great difficulty resettling their minds. Then Krishna tells the story of the Avanti Brahmana, who concluded that the whole problem was the mind. And if you could keep the mind stable in all conditions, which he was able to do, he developed neutrality. People would take the food he had begged, they'd take his japa beads, they would take his old torn cloth, they would spit on him, they'd say, oh, you just became renounced because your family kicked you out. And he stayed, and they would sometimes tie him up with chains, and he always stayed neutral. So that's a very high, high, high platform, which Krishna says hardly anyone can achieve. When we were doing some work for the Krishna Vanti School, we were looking at festivals because the UK demands that the children have a collective worship program every morning, and we decided to center it on festivals. So we chose mostly Vaishnava festivals, but we also had a few Hindu festivals, Christian, Jewish, Buddhist, and Jain, so they would be familiar with these other traditions. And for the Jain, we celebrated about the appearance of Mahavir. So Mahavir decided he was going to become neutral, and like a good Jain, he traveled naked, right, and didn't talk to anyone. And even one time he got a thorn in his eye and he didn't take it out. He just waited until somebody came along and took it out of his eye. And so he practiced this absolute neutrality, the absolute stability of the mind, where the mind is so still that one experiences an inner joy that's not dependent on sense perception or on praise of others. But that's extremely difficult. After 13 years of these severe practices, he achieved this mental equanimity and neutrality. But we find, of course, Avasuddha Buddhaya, that such people are not really purified. They're not really purified. Even if you go through 13 years of such great austerity, you wander around naked, you don't talk to anybody, you make no attempt whatsoever to get anything good, and you make no attempt whatsoever to get rid of anything bad. You make full attempt just to tolerate everything. Still, your intelligence is not yet purified. Because who's still at the center? Yourself, yes. So we find that many of these great yogis and jnanis who achieve this equanimity, they're not able to maintain it under certain circumstances. Or even if they go into the Brahmajyoti, they may again come down. Because the soul doesn't want simply neutrality. That's not really the solution. It's just like if you're sick, okay, you don't want just the disease to be gone, you want to be healthy and full of energy, right? Isn't that a fact? Yes? You don't want just the problem to be gone, you want something positive. If someone gives you bad food, you don't want no food, you want good food. You don't just want to get rid of your enemies, you want friends. You understand what I'm saying? We want something positive. We don't just want this neutrality. So higher than neutrality is compassion. And it's interesting that even among the voidists and the impersonalists, they know that higher than neutrality is compassion. If the Buddhists and the Mayavadis really believe their philosophy, why would they aim for compassion? Does that make sense to everybody? Why would Buddhists and impersonalists preach that compassion is higher than neutrality? Why have compassion? If everything, if nothing exists, really, and the whole purpose is just mental stability and neutrality, why help people?
Maybe you want to say something?
Sure.
Question?
Yeah.
Well, I was just thinking, my thought is that also that expression of compassion can be envy, because you are helping those who are on lower stage than you, they're suffering more, so it derives from pleasure.
Oh, well, it can be.
Washing your hands.
That can be, in fact, most compassion in this world is actually envious. Sorry about that. But most compassion is actually envious, because it puts you in a higher position. In fact, you know, the biggest charity givers are in what mode of material nature?
Passion.
The biggest philanthropists are generally in the mode of passion. There's also charity in the modes of ignorance and goodness. But the real big charity givers are in the mode of passion. And their mood is, I am giving you something. Just see how great I am. Right? Bali Maharaj got into this mood. I always find this humorous. Bali Maharaj said to Vamandev, hey, what are you doing? You're a little boy. You don't know what you're doing. You have no intelligence. Said, you should ask me. What did he say? You should ask me for?
Benediction.
Yeah, but which benediction? What did he say he should ask for? What benediction did Bali Maharaj tell Vamandev he should ask for? He said, I own the universe. I own everything. You should ask me for something so great that you'll never need to ask anybody else for anything ever. Did Bali have that to give? No. Who's the only person who has that to give?
Krishna.
So the mood of the charity giver is often like this. I'm not helping you because I love you and I care about you, but I'm helping you because I'm superior. When you help due to envy, what's going to be your limit of helping? Remember, envy is I never want anyone equal or greater than me. So I'm only going to help till somebody's what? Still below me. Still below me. I will not help somebody become equal to me. My compassion has a limit. I will have compassion for you. You've got to be at least, you know, a millimeter below me. Then my compassion is over. So how do you know if compassion is based on envy, that I have to maintain my superior position? I'm giving out of a mood of superiority, and I will only give up to the point where I maintain my superior position. A lot of religious preaching is done in this mood, by the way. A lot of the so-called preaching in the world by religious people is in an envious mood. I am preaching to you because I know more than you, you fool. You hog, dog, camel, and ass. But real compassion is very different. Real compassion is above neutrality. And real compassion is described in the fourth canto by Narada Muni, that when you see someone higher than you, you become very joyful. Wow! Somebody's achieved something that I couldn't achieve. How fortunate they are, how wonderful they are, how glorious. How glorious. You become joyful. When somebody's equal to you, you make friends with them. And when someone's lower than you, you try to pull them up. And you get happy if they go above you. And Prabhupada says in the purport, genuine people are above us, we try to pull them down. When they're equal to us, we brag and try to put ourselves above them. And when they're lower than us, we exploit them to keep them lower than us. So real compassion is very different. Real compassion is based on the fact that we are all souls, that we are all equal, that we are all, in a sense, one. We have the same quality, we're all part of the Lord, and therefore anyone who achieves anything else also, I'm also part of them. You know, you see this somewhat especially with parents and children, that of all the people who will genuinely delight in someone excelling them, we find this most often with parents and children. That a parent can have a genuine joy at their child being better than they are. Why? Because they feel the child is an extension of themselves, exactly. They feel the child is an extension of themselves. Yes?
Would that not be also like the parent who sees how much they've done for the child?
Yes, they may see the child's accomplishments as their accomplishments, exactly. They may feel, yes, my child has excelled me because I am such a great parent.
Yeah.
Yes. So Prabhupada calls this extended selfishness. But even though it's extended selfishness, it's one of the few relationships where you're likely to find this kind of behavior, where a person is likely to actively want and delight for another person to excel. You know, even between husband and wife, you don't always find this. You know, you don't always find. The husband isn't always happy if the wife is more talented than he is in some area, and the wife isn't always happy if the husband is more accomplished in some area. So even between husband and wife, it's not as common as between parents and children, although it's still ultimately materialistic. Huh? But the reason you find this, particularly in a family, is that we feel that the family is one. You follow? You're most likely to find at least something that looks like lack of envy in a family. This is very nicely explained by Krishna in the 32nd chapter of the 10th canto, where he talks about different kinds of relationships. And in fact, Prahlad is also indicated there by the Acharyas. That Krishna says the best kind of relationship is where you delight in someone else's happiness. You're not looking for something for yourself, and this is found in the family, and is also found among great devotees like Prahlad. So the reason it's found in a family is, again, this sense of oneness. We have a sense of oneness. That if a different member of the family excels me, it's also my excelling because we're one. On the spiritual level, the devotee also feels that way. We're all one. Therefore, anyone who excels is also my happiness. My happiness is connected to that of all living beings. This concept of separateness, of absolute separateness, is one of the main components of illusion. And we find, and we look at this, of course, with Srimati Radharani, why are the gopis and Srimati Radharani 100 times or 10 million times happier when the other gopis are enjoying with Krishna? Because they have this sense of connectedness and oneness. That her good fortune is my good fortune. In fact, her good fortune is more than my good fortune. Just like a parent, if you give a gift to their child, they're happier than if you give a gift to themselves. And then of all the devotees who exhibit compassion, Prahlad Maharaj, we can say, is the best. He's the ultimate example of this compassion. Because who are we least likely to be compassionate to? To our enemies. And of all the living entities that we're going to show compassion to, we're most likely to show compassion to people with whom we identify. Does that make sense to everybody? We're most likely to show compassion to members of our own clan, Swajana, our own people. You know, first off to our blood family, and then, you know, maybe to those who have the same race as we do, you know, same color skin, from the same country, they speak the same language, or they're from the same region of the same country. And we're less likely to show compassion to people that are kind of neutral, and we're the least likely to show compassion to those who harm us. In fact, we usually actively desire their harm in return. And Prahlad Maharaj, when he's asked, what do you want? So, you know, if Gopinath were to walk down off the altar, kind of big steps there. So if he would walk down off the altar and he would walk in the temple room and walk up to you and say, so, I would like to give you whatever you want. No, I'm not a merchant. I'm just here doing bhakti because everyone else is watching, so we want to be very detached. No, I insist. It's my pastime to give benedictions. What would you like? Would we pick our greatest enemy and say, please bless them? Would that be the one thing we would ask for? Just imagine that. The Lord's going to give you one blessing. One blessing. I don't want your blessing. I insist. And then you think, wow, what is the person who's harmed me the most? Can you take care of them? Can you liberate them? Can you be kind to them? Would anybody do that? Honestly, would anybody do that? But Prahlad did that. So he's the best among even the Mahajanas. Even among all these Mahajanas, Swayambhu Manu, Narada Muni, Lord Shiva, the four Kumaras, Lord Kapila, the Manus, King Janaka, Bhishma, Bali Maharaj, Sukadeva Goswami, and Yamaraj. And still, Prahlad is the highest. Because when he had one thing to ask for, only one thing to ask for, he asked for compassion, and he asked for compassion to the very person that he'd be least likely to be compassionate for. Therefore, his compassion was unbounding. Now, how do we get this compassion? This is the last thing we'll look at. Nisingadeva is saying here, because of being attached to devotional service, which we also read in the 11th canto, where Krishna is saying, it's only through devotional service. The only way, my dear friends, to completely give up envy, the only way to completely give up envy, is not just through jnana or yoga or austerities to become neutral, or even to practice compassion separately, but to fall in love with Krishna. Because when we fall in love with Krishna, some very amazing things happen. First of all of our desires are fulfilled. We no longer worry about whether I'll have enough. One of the reasons that we're envious is we worry there won't be enough, right? I used to be in charge of the Janmashtami serve out in North Carolina, and I made all the servers make up their own plate first. Because I experienced that after fasting all day, if there were some preparations in smaller quantity, they wouldn't be generous. So I said, you make your own plates first. So a lot of the reason we're envious is, I went to a meeting run by the New Vrajajam devotees in Hungary on the environment, and they had also non-devotee speakers, and one of these was big guy, you know, big professor guy. He was speaking in Hungarian, was being translated. I wonder if I was the only American in the audience. And he was saying, our goal is that everyone on the planet should enjoy equal to the Americans. And I was really wondering, you know, if I was the only American there. He said, and the only way to do this is to limit population. There's too many people for the world's resources. Therefore, we have to actively propagate birth control and abortion and sterilization, especially to the people who are poor and uneducated. He said that right on the stage, folks. Talk about envy. So that's our mood. You know, we may not grossly get up and say that, but we think like that. How much sweet rice is in the maha container? How many people are in the line? How much can I get away with taking without being criticized? You know, this is the... So when we're full with love of Krishna, we don't think that way anymore. Om purnama da purnama idam purna purna da jate purnasya purnama daya purnam eva vasishyate. The unlimited minus the unlimited equals unlimited. We get unlimited, and everybody else can get unlimited too, because there's unlimited to go around for everybody. You can take unlimited away from the unlimited, and still the unlimited remains. So we have so much satisfaction and so much happiness that is just overflowing. And we really don't mind if everybody else has unlimited happiness and satisfaction also. We're not thinking, you know, I've got to hoard these resources. The other thing is that, and this is really funny and really sweet and really amazing and translogical, is that when we fall in love with Krishna, we really feel that we are the best and the center and the most important. Krishna does that for every single devotee. So imagine you're in the rasa dance with Krishna, there's billions of gopis, but your experience is what?
It's only about you.
It's only about me. I'm Krishna's favorite. You're sitting around Krishna with the other cowherd boys taking prasadam. Billions of cowherd boys, and Krishna's at the center. And what's your experience? Krishna's just with me. He's just looking at me.
And we feel like that also here.
Yes. So when we become perfect in devotional service, we become the most important person to the most important person. I mean, here, you know, you can be a big important person, maybe if you're lucky, to your spouse. You know, or maybe if you're lucky to your kids, maybe you'll get in the history book and somebody will have to memorize your name for an exam they don't want to take. You know, when Darnie, I tell her she has to study the history of the countries that we go to, and she says, Grandma, it's so boring. It's just all these lists of names of kings. Those were the biggest guys in the country, you know, and then after they're dead, some school kid is saying, oh man, I got to remember their names. So, you know, maybe we can become important to somebody in this world for 10 years. But suppose we're the most important person to God. Would we care? Would we have this urge to put anybody down? Would we? So we have everything we want, and we're the most important person to God. When one has that, then one becomes free from it. Therefore, we should aspire for that relationship. And that will automatically, beautifully nullify this, all of the evil in our heart that makes us feel ashamed and embarrassed and awkward and causes us so many problems. So we could have time maybe for just one or two questions, because we've run out of time. Yes, Bill.
Thank you very much, Dr. Duma, for your class. Thank you so much. Regarding the confession, I would like to ask you, if possible, one short question, a little bit.
Sure.
At least last point about being in center, you know, when we are free from envy. But we also see the example of Radharani, where she felt that she is the most important. She also lost Krishna. So that's
she also lost Krishna. She was, well,
disappeared.
Well, the acharyas explain that what happened was she started thinking about the other gopis. She started feeling sorry that Krishna was just with her and that the other gopis were looking for Krishna. So she wanted to find a way to again bring all the gopis back together again. So therefore she said, you know, oh, why don't you just, you know, just carry me on your shoulders. And then Krishna left. And when Krishna left, all the gopis became sympathetic to Srimati Radharani, even her rivals. And the feeling of rivalry left. Because Krishna likes that there's competition between the gopis. I mean, even an ordinary man would like to have various women fighting over him. You know, the concept of competition is very pleasing to Krishna. But sometimes it's not. Sometimes Krishna doesn't want there to be competition between the gopis. Sometimes he wants there to be cooperation. So Srimati Radharani, understanding that that was Krishna's desire at that point, behaved like that. And then the gopis all came together and all looked for Krishna as a group, and they were all sympathetic to Srimati Radharani. But Krishna does, if one of the gopis becomes proud, any of the devotees, if any of them become proud of being Krishna's favorite, then Krishna does withdraw. Because he doesn't want it to lead to that kind of thing. He doesn't want it to lead to I'm the best. So if it even starts to in any little way, he withdraws and says, wait a minute, you know, it's not like that. You're the best because I love you, not because you're the best. You know, I read a story about a man who's, after he died, I forget how many kids he had, 5 or 6 or something, and after he died, the kids were saying to each other, you know, Dad always told me that I was his favorite and not to tell the rest of you, and they all had the same story. So Krishna's like that, you know. Krishna will say to you, you're my favorite, and you are his favorite. But if you start saying, well, I'm Krishna's favorite, then, you know, he's not so happy with that. And then he'll change, Prabhupada says he'll change his dealings with you if you start thinking like that. Because it's love. It's just love. You know, no matter how many children the parent has, they have love for each of the children. And when they're with a particular child, they're fascinated by that child. When Krishna is with us, he's fascinated by us. And he's able to be with each of us simultaneously. So he's totally fascinated by us, always. But if we think, oh, that means I'm better than anybody else, then he's like, no, sorry, that's not what it means. You can't maintain that. He's, I'm not gonna facilitate that kind of thing. Anybody else? Yes?
When we are new devotee, just 4 years that I'm in Krishna consciousness, it's difficult to understand why some devotee who have knowledge don't come to share or give mercy or stay distant, just Hari Bol. And it's very hard sometimes for the hearts to
I would suggest that the main person we should just try to understand is ourselves.
Yes.
Yeah. And not so much worry about trying to understand why other people have this problem or that problem. I mean, if we want the best way, if we want to analyze these problems, is to look at the people in the scripture who are given to us as examples of what to do and what not to do. We can safely do that. We are supposed to be doing that, and we should not so much do that with the people in our community, because if we do that with the people in our community, that may be dangerous for us. We need to do that with the people in our community in a practical way, to know with whom to associate and how to associate with them. But it's probably not such a good idea to psychoanalyze. So maybe a practical thing, I may say, look, this is a person that I respect them, but I'm not going to associate with them so much. This is a person I can be friends with. This is a person I can serve. But it's probably not such a good idea to get into analyzing them psychologically and spiritually, because our tendency when we do that is going to be to find fault and then to posit ourselves as higher. That's going to be our tendency, and not to do that will be extremely difficult.
Yes, and don't be focused on study and all that, because we personally have personal time to feel and analyze, and I don't want to find fault, but I feel
I would prefer, I think it's safer if we analyze ourselves and the people in the scripture who've been analyzed. And don't so much worry about the other.
Yes, I want to have the perfection.
So that would be better. And some people you may choose, you know, maybe these are people that I don't associate with so closely. That's okay. But why people do what they do, I don't know. I'm not always sure why I do what I do. So I don't know why people do what they do. And everyone has good qualities and faults. So this is a very nice section in the Bhagavad Gita where the goddess of fortune is deciding who to marry. And I was talking on the phone with a devotee who's now in her 30s and still not married because she can't find the perfect man. And you know, I said, good luck with that. So the goddess of fortune, as if we're the perfect woman, you know, this is also kind of silly. So, you know, the goddess of fortune, she's saying, okay, this person has this good quality but this fault. This person has this good quality but this fault. This quality, this good quality, this. Only Lord Narayana has no faults. Yes?
If you want to say, like, this quality, like, for instance, of compassion, even for our enemies, people we don't like, if we kind of know that that is something that Krishna wants us to have, but we're not on that level yet, but we act on that level, even though maybe in our heart we feel like, oh, I really don't want to do this.
Krishna will help you.
Oh,
he does. He very much does. When we try to do things that are difficult for us in order to please Krishna, Krishna will always help. He will always help. And it's not that hard. This is ninth verse in the sixth chapter where Krishna says we should see the distress and happiness of others like our own. If we take the people who are difficult to us and say to ourselves, this is someone like me. Because remember, we tend to have the most compassion for people who we think are like us. Our same family, our same race, our same nationality, or whatever, something, our compassion tend to flows to somewhere where we think there's sameness. So if we can just have a little mantra, this is just a person like me. They don't like suffering, they like happiness, just like I do. May they find happiness and be free from suffering. Simple, simple, simple mantra. It's getting late and people are already leaving because I'm going over time. And I think it's already 5 to 9, and there's a little sign here. All right. Just don't get me in trouble with Manu.
Who already left. That's not an issue for long. I'm coming from a Christian background.
Yeah, yeah.
Embodiment for compassion in Jesus Christ, because
yes.
He was able to be the human. He experienced human miseries, and that reason he was able to be compassionate. And ultimately, Krishna, he is always transcendental. He doesn't feel the miseries. And my question is, how Krishna can really then be compassionate?
I've accused him of that. I've said to Krishna, I've accused him of that when I was really in a suffering condition. I've said, how do you know? You don't know. Of course he does know. You know why? No, because he's God. There you go, great answer. But what are we? Okay, Krishna has Swamsa expansions and Vibhinansa expansions. Who are the Vibhinansa expansions? We are. Krishna is experiencing what we're experiencing. So he does know. We are Vibhinansa expansions. We are considered one of the incarnations of the Lord. We are the Vibhinansa incarnations of the Lord. So he does know. He does feel what we feel.
So, because according to the Adikeshwar's book, you know, there is a clear distinction. You know, he always speaks about that. So that's always my issue.
Knows.
It's completely transcendental.
Actually, even it says the demigods, they experience the sense pleasures of the humans. They're drinking through the cups of the humans' senses. And so they really are happy when Krishna incarnates and they get to drink through the cups of the senses of the residents of Vrindavan their ecstasies upon being with Krishna. So now Krishna does. Yeah, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.